The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board.
Woo!
Back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha / Zone Coverage on Twitter at Zone Coverage MN. I'm your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon _ Warren. I am joined, as I have been for quite some time, to my right by the Shryducer, copyright Bob Sansevier in the BS Show.
Now I'm the Shry Kick. Bob Sansevier is producing his own show.
Really?
Not really. I press the buttons a lot.
you do push a lot of buttons. I can attest to that. Speaking of buttons being pushed, no, I'm just kidding. On the phone today, Mike Berardino, St. Paul Pioneer Press. Mike, we're coming off game number one and victory number one for the Minnesota Twins. But first of all, how are you doing today coming off a North Carolina Tar Heels national championship?
I like the sound of that. I'm pleased. And, the fact that, there's a marathon investigation going on there, and I think we all kind of know eventually there will be a hammer to fall. It's good that the Tar Heels got this one in under the wire.
Now, that final sequence by Gonzaga was pretty ugly.
The whole game was ugly, and we're blaming the referees for that. It was just tweet fest and just unbelievably tightly called. I will say that, this is a baseball show, so I won't go too far on it, but I don't think it's any accident that in the last 2 years, the NCAA made a clear point of emphasis for their officiating to call the game more tightly. And I remember reading that going into the previous season, and Carolina has now reached the last two finals. And I think if they could have played under these rules, these touch foul rules, because they've always been taught, of course, to play by moving their feet and not grabbing and clutching in Duke fashion, I think the course of history would have been quite different, and Dean Smith would have had about seven more national titles if they got to play under these rules. I don't think it's any accident that Carolina's way is working so well now, because they always have. If they're going to win any war of attrition, they're going to have more depth. They're going to have all these McDonald's All-Americans, and then they really do try to play without grabbing and clutching. And you saw what Karnowski did to poor Joel Berry, and I tweeted that. I mean, that was you do that on the street, they lock you up.
Yeah, I think I saw too online that it was the worst offensive game of the season for Gonzaga, and something like the fifth worst for North Carolina. So, might have been something in the stars that aligned last night, that both teams had off offensive nights. The one thing I was lamenting, obviously, I picked a bunk bracket anyway. My championship was going to be Arizona over Kansas. Every single year, they make you do the tiebreaker, the score.
Yeah.
I pick 70-65 every single year. It was 71-65 last night, and I told my wife, and she looks at the screen, and she just kind of stares blankly at me, and that's kind of what I deserve when I try to interject sports with her. But we watched that last sequence. And
do you know that I won our bracket challenge for Zone Coverage?
Really?
We're going to give it to the second place winner.
Do we know who that?
The second place, we don't know. I don't know why that's not available to us right now.
Sure.
So if you entered our bracket challenge, you might have won if you picked well. But I honestly got it on the back of the Tar Heels, because I had Kansas there, I had Gonzaga losing to West Virginia, and I had Villanova.
So now you're appealing to Mike's sensibilities.
Yeah, Mike and I stand behind those Tar Heels. It's always been that
way. I'll out myself. I'm pretty open with it. I did think that Kentucky, which beat Carolina in a shootout early in the season, I thought that they would match up in the final eight, and I thought Kentucky would get them again, because they were the ones who were spiking up, and Calipari certainly knows how to do the one-and-done thing. It's nice to see seniors rewarded. It's nice to see loyalty rewarded, and I picked Arizona to win it all going in. I think Sean Miller's a heck of a coach, and will win multiple national titles eventually, and I thought he was loaded this year. But I hate to jinx the team, so I generally pick against them. But at some point, I see fatalities happening. But I thought Kentucky would be the one that would get them. But that was a Luke May. I covered his dad as a quarterback at Carolina. Mark May was supposed to be NFL quality, a great, great guy. And so he made his contribution to Carolina history. He just did it through his son.
Now, quick before we get into Twins stuff, Mark Topkin, the intrepid reporter for Tampa Bay Times, reporting this morning, Jose De Leon had what Rays say was minor discomfort in his flexor mass muscle and forearm last week and is, quote, since resolved with rest. Now, that is going to appeal a little bit to Twins fans' sensibilities in that that was the reported possible return if Brian Dozier, instead of Logan Forsythe, had been traded to the Dodgers. Any thoughts based on that? Obviously not a bullet dodged, really, but it just, I think the point that I made all along was, you just can't put all your eggs in a young pitcher basket, a non-elite pitching prospect basket, and I think the Twins were wise to rebuff those efforts.
No doubt. And, this is another WBC competitor who's now on the shelf. And Seth Lugo, his Puerto Rico, Team Puerto Rico teammate now with a slight UCL tear for the Mets. That's a big setback. Drew Smyly with issues. And he was tremendous for Team USA.
Yeah, that's not a feather in the cap of the WBC, those three guys.
No, and it's not surprising at all. I mean, duh, you're asking guys to go every fourth year from the laid-back environment, no adrenaline whatsoever in spring training, to flag-waving intensity, and how can you possibly not extend yourself at times a little? If anything, the surprise is there aren't more pitching-related injuries at the WBC. I mean, it is the fatal flaw in what's otherwise a really fun event. Is that there's no perfect time to do this. If you try to do it in November, there's exhaustion. If you try to do it when they do it now, they're not amped up yet. They're not stretched out, and then the intensity, they're just not ready for that. And I think the percentage is still pretty low. But from a Twins perspective, I got to see De Leon from right behind home plate. The one game I went to as a fan with my son when he was down there. And the Rays came through, and he was, he got a strong lower half, and you can see he's got a pitch mix, and you can see that you can see some of the projection that's there still, but it's still a lot of projection, and he's a self-made prospect. He wasn't one of these guys who was sought after as a teen. He went to Southern University and was an afterthought in a 23rd round or whatever, and just worked really hard to get to that level. And like you, I don't. We're not going to be able to judge that entirely right now, but all along, De Leon fronting that package even didn't feel like enough. And when I talked to Rick Knapp, the former Dodgers minor league pitching coordinator, former Twins minor league pitching coordinator, former Tigers major league pitching coach, he likes De Leon, but he said flat out that the Twins should have been able to give, that was the offer, they should have been able to get a Bellinger in there too, because there's that much of a gap and what Dozier's done demonstrably in the majors at a reasonable rate, and what these prospects from a system that wasn't as strong as was being portrayed in the offseason, were not quite as strong. There's some fun names on that Dodger list, but it's not like those are just automatics. There are no guarantees, and it would have been fun to go picking through there for three pieces or something, but Brian Dozier might be exactly the guy that shortens the window here for the Twins to get back to respectability right here.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think we saw that on display yesterday. Before I lead you along down the path that I choose, I do want to get your unfiltered thoughts about opening day. Again, just a snapshot in time, which is, when I broke down the opening day roster, and I'm sure you got 10 times as many upset tweets about Byung-ho Park not making the team in the roster construction than I did. It's just a snapshot in time. You can't lose sight of the fact that on opening day, you might win, you might lose, and it might not matter at all. But based on what you saw yesterday, just give us your general breakdown of how the day went beginning to end.
Wow. Well, it was a long day. You find yourself standing in the clubhouse pregame for a 3 o'clock game, which is kind of an odd time anyway. And you have people who haven't had a chance to be around the team at all spring because they weren't sent down to Florida. And they're asking the kind of questions that they need for pregame video, I guess, or maybe they don't need them at all. But it's just like it was kind of pointless, the pregame run-up to it. It was like, just can we play an actual game already? And so now it's, you get this, you have to build in this day off because of the weather concerns always. Everybody does it. But once you get an actual game in the books that you actually paid attention to pitch by pitch, although I'm sick enough to chart the starting pitcher in the spring.
It's a disease. It's a disease.
I'm just getting myself into mid-season form in that way as well. But it also helps to know what they're working on and if they're, what they're telling you jives with reality. I would say that Irvin Santana takeaway, building off of a fine spring where he seemed to have the command that he will need. Although early on his fastball command was pretty spotty. He was missing by several feet. But then he leaned more and more on that slider. I think we're going to see Jason Castro and Chris Jimenez are going to be a lot of fun for this pitching staff to throw to and to lean on. Not just the, well beyond the pitch framing part of it. I mean, they seem to check all the boxes defensively, and the ability to keep people on path and calm them down when necessary, fire them up when necessary. I just think as much as I respect Kurt Suzuki and what he's done in his career, we've talked about it. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to see the upgrade between the Suzuki Centeno combination and these two guys. And then you have Murphy and Garver down at AAA if anything happens, and they're really coming along too with the defensive side of the game. So the Twins, you really can make the case that they have finally, defensively at least, gotten their catching situation back to where it was pre-concussion for Maurer.
So I find this interesting. SI does a preview for each of the teams. They have the Twins as a 69-win team.
That's pretty nice.
And they
sorry, Mike.
No, there's so they have a rival scout. It says sizes up Minnesota, and obviously these guys can't use their name. But you would assume,
yeah, it's actually against the rules, as Pat
said
last week.
Pat pointed this out, and it is their trade. But I thought some interesting comments, and I want to get your opinion. So he actually said they gave Jason Castro a lot of money to be their frontline guy. They had a good defensive catcher in Kurt Suzuki and let him walk. I would rather have Suzuki than Castro. Yeah, isn't that interesting? So there's a couple other things he wrote, and I'm curious what you guys have to say, because this is what, and again, I don't know what SI's distribution is anymore, but this is kind of what the national people, I guess, would be reading about the Twins. They say Irvin Santana is their ace, but is actually a three. Do you agree?
Yeah, he's probably a two or three. Yeah, that's not terribly bad.
Maybe it's
unfair. People thought, and yes, those several of those comments seem to be off. And here's the thing you got to keep in mind: I sure hope, people. It's just confirmation bias for people who want to denigrate scouts and say that they're just there and they're not paying attention and they're outmoded and useless. That's crap. Mm-hmm.
That
SI writer caught up with a particularly out of touch or unprepared for a Twins line of questioning scout.
Interesting.
That same scout you might have caught up with on a variety of other teams, maybe, and found insightful and accurate and things that everyone would agree on, possibly. Or their job is not to just confirm what we all think, but to find the differences and the trend lines and to stay on it in that way. But I had conversations with plenty of scouts this spring who were passing through and would relay through Twitter and sometimes in stories that what they were thinking about the Twins as they watched them. Teams do it differently. For instance, the Brewers these days, their scouts focus more on the opponent's minor league systems, even AA and below, and they're pro scouts. They're not going to be focusing so much on the majors because they're in rebuilding mode and they're looking to trade off major league assets for minor league talent. So if you were to talk to a Brewers scout, for instance, and they have probably a dozen pro scouts, you would be more apt to get finer points on their thoughts with the AA and below prospects, but they might not know the major league roster as well. There's other teams that split it up maybe eight teams per scout and or eight organizations, and they have to have a working knowledge of the entire organization. That's 200 some players, but they're not going to necessarily zone in as closely on the major league team. Then you have the advanced scouts who focus entirely on the major league roster, and I know some of those guys too. And if you really, SI would have been better served probably getting an advanced scout who happens to have the Twins, because that person needs to know day to day, week to week, depending on when his organization is going to face the Twins, what they're doing, right down to trying to figure out their signs. And there's some of these advanced scouts who are still really good. And Paul Molitor and Torrey Hunter aren't the only people who can pick up pitch tipping and sign sequences. So the big picture is I've seen some of the comments on Twitter, like, you know, well, there you go. That just proves it. Scouts are stupid. That's not true.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting insight. Did you have something?
No, I think the questionable thing is Joe Mauer is just an opposite field hitter now.
It's I saw
okay,
that.
Okay, well, Joe Mauer's been an opposite field hitter since he was drafted in 2001.
That scout did a bad job. I don't want to talk any more about that particular one.
Okay, sure.
Because I haven't read the other 29, and that's not all from one scout, obviously.
Right.
And I have, you know, the Sporting News, I believe, when I do annual updates or Twins previews for the Sporting News and for Athlon, and I believe it's Sporting News where it is, that they also want you to talk to a scout about a team in the middle of the winter. And, you know, SI, they have a shorter time frame between those conversations and going to print. But, you know, the deadline on Sporting News is around the holidays. And so sometimes I'm having a conversation with a scout and putting those scout thoughts on a team in, you know, sending them in. And then there's going to be further signings, and there's going to be, you know, some things just won't seem as realistic as they did in December. So you have to factor that in too. But, you know, then there might also be the case where the scout is working with some outdated information, but or it might even not be. You might catch one who's not going to give you the unvarnished truth, even with the cover of anonymity, and that's someone that you need to see through that. I don't remember who wrote that part for SI. They've had a lot of turnover in their.
I think it was Joe Shahan, but I'm not sure.
Joe wrote that, really?
No, well, I don't know. He wrote the intro to the whole scouting thing.
Probably just a, you know, a lower or newer employee, possibly at SI, someone you know, who's still learning the business or even baseball and might not have seen through those comments. And then for those to get through their baseball editors, that's not good. That's disappointing. But by and large, SI, of course, still excellent.
So back to yesterday, Mike. So as far as my recap, you know, I do it a little bit different than the traditional newspaper guys. I'll go a little bit later than everybody else, but try to get a little more video and all that, which is, you know, it's a unique perspective. But so I basically want to go over what I saw yesterday and then get your thoughts on it, see if we sync up, and if not, you can give me an education. How does that sound?
I'll just say pass. No,
okay. Well, I think so the first point I had was you know, Byron Buxton obviously 0-for-5, 3 strikeouts in the number 3 hole. I think what he showed yesterday is that he's got value outside of the bat. I think anybody with half a brain knows that, but I think yesterday that was perfectly on display. That, you know, people who like Fangraphs or even Baseball Reference WAR can see why he might be a 3-4 win player this year, even if he only hits 240 with a 720 OPS.
Yes, and that builds on the fact that in talking with Byron, I think he said it at the Diamond Awards. He said it several times to me this spring. He said, I'm a defensive player first. And what does that do? And you're talking about a number 3 hole hitter, at least to start the year, saying I'm a defensive player first. What does that do? That keeps him fully engaged. Even on an 0-for-5, 3 strikeout day, he's not going to beat himself up, because even if he doesn't make those 2 diving catches, he knows that there will be an opportunity somewhere in there, especially with the fly ball pitcher, that he can change the game, and he wants to change the game. So it also takes pressure off him when he does have failure at the plate, and failure is going to be part of it, especially at this stage of his career. So I like the mentality there. He's looking, and I like the collective identity of those 3 outfielders who will get the bulk of the starts as long as Rosario and Kepler can hold their own against lefties. We're going to see Grossman I think, still spotting in there, and Danny Santana spotting in there in the outfield against tougher lefties. But, you know, there's a – we're looking hard for a nickname for him. I've asked people on Twitter to submit. Nothing has bubbled to the surface yet. I'm going to challenge myself to have a working one that I can endorse by the end of the week for the Rosario Buxton Kepler combo. They moved their lockers in the home clubhouse. They moved Buxton and Rosario across the room to Kepler's side of things. Mm-hmm. So they're lined up right there. Although Rosario's in the middle, and I asked Buxton about that. That seemed out of whack, but Byron's just glad to be away from the lost and found, because that was always the case. But I think fans are going to enjoy seeing this trio, long as Rosario can keep his head above water and keep hitting. That makes a combined $1.6 million or so. That's fun to watch.
So he said that the outfielder's motto this year is nothing falls but raindrops. He said it in his very, very likable Southern drawl, very unassuming guy. And I think that's kind of a fun thing, a fun motto to have. They were impressive yesterday. You know, there was, Kepler made a couple plays that, you know, they looked pretty routine, and I think maybe that was the Jeff Pickler factor, having him positioned well. Not much for Rosario, but then Buxton had the two great plays, or one great play, and then one that he made up for with his makeup speed. I think this outfield defense can be a definite asset, and it's going to be, for the first time since the Twins had the Soul Patrol out there in Jock Jones and Torrey Hunter and Matt Lawton or Shannon Stewart, it's the first time in a long time that this outfield defense is going to be an asset.
Yeah, and the fact that all three of them can play center field and did get a chance to play center field in the spring, and Rosario did some even at the WBC, I think they all can handle center. Obviously, Buxton could be an elite center fielder. That adds to the go-get-it mentality and ability. The throwing in each case, average to well above average, and accurate. Kepler's arm strength doesn't match up with the other two necessarily, but he's very accurate. And again, a collective mentality that will take offensive pressure off all three of them as they kind of claim credit for each other's defensive prowess sometimes. I mean, you Rosario might be sitting over there on a night where he goes 0-for-5 with three strikeouts, but if the outfield as a group is taking away hits and leading to victory, that eases some of the disappointment. I do believe in that. And not every outfield gets to experience that, especially when you're talking about the age range that these guys are in. So it's that's all pretty healthy stuff. And, of course, if the overall mentality of the team becomes a team that's going to catch the ball first and not give away outs, which would be polar opposite from what we saw too often last season, mm-hmm. that would be very positive. That's going to be harder on the infield, especially on the left side of the infield, where Sano really should have, I think, I didn't watch five replays of it, but it seemed like he should have been charged with his first error already. But who cares, because he hit a ball about 5,000 feet.
Top four batters in the order yesterday combined to go 1-for-15. Team still scored 7 runs on 8 hits. Dozier, Grossman, Buxton, and Maurer 1-4. Did walk 4 times, but also 7 strikeouts. I think the bottom of the order carried the water yesterday. I was surprised by that. I think 7-9 with Kepler and Polanco. Actually, I believe it was Polanco, Kepler, Rosario. One of the more dynamic 7-9s the Twins have had in quite some time. A few people on Twitter made the point that that's probably because they were facing a lefty, and obviously I tend to agree. But I was impressed with what the bottom of the order did yesterday, especially Jason Castro. A couple of carbon copy singles over the head of Moustakas at third. I did tweet yesterday, and I got a favorite from Stanford Baseball. I said that Stanford-educated catcher Jason Castro opts not to check to test the arm strength of Alex Gordon in left. And I said, the story checks out. But obviously, a very smart player. Again, though, I was just impressed. 6 of the 8 hits for the team came from guys who were hitting 6th or lower. That was an impressive offensive effort from the bottom of the order yesterday.
Yeah, and I don't think you're going to get three bases loaded walks very often.
Right.
So you don't want to again, just one game, it becomes magnified because of it's the first, and because it was home, there was a greater turnout in terms of the media, and the fans are there, sellout crowd. We'll see how many more of those they can muster. But that's, you know, of course, when you end an eight-year opening day losing streak, and when you finally take your first lead on opening day after 78 straight innings of being tied or losing, going back to the second Bush administration, that's a good thing to turn the page on.
Yeah, where were you on opening day of 2008?
At a Marlins game. I don't know where exactly, but they, you know, again, I've long been conditioned not to. I've long been taught and understood to just ignore the kind of things that you're saying here. I realize we have a podcast to do, so we're going to read a lot into game one, whereas game seven, we wouldn't even dream of trying to read much into
sure. The
production. But let's say on a big picture, something that is sustainable is that this year, unlike last year or the year before, it appears that Paul Molitor is going to, he certainly wasn't afraid to experiment with his lineups last couple of years, but he's going to have a right-handed lineup and a left-handed lineup, depending on the opposing starting pitcher. And he's not afraid to move people lower than they've ever hit before. So Mauer was cleanup, something he hadn't done against any type of pitcher for more than a decade. However, against lefties, he had pretty good numbers against Danny Duffy in his career, but against lefties that have eaten him up, or when Joe gets into these periods where, you know, he's just struggling, obviously, against lefties, he's going to hit as low as seventh, I believe. And I think this is a good thing. And Kepler will be moved up against righties to hit second a lot of times. I think you're going to see that very quickly here. So the fact that Kepler can bounce from the bottom third to the top third, and there will be more of that sort of bouncing as depending on matchups, depending on fly ball, ground ball guys, depending on a wide range of factors. He wants everybody to be fluid and able to adjust and not get all locked in. Now, the one thing that might just stay constant, and it's going to drive fans crazy, I see that already, is Dozier, I think, is just going to stay in the leadoff spot and for the time being. And that's what Dozier wants. And Molitor makes the point that he does not ignore the numbers, but he also leaves room for the comfort and the human side of where a player is in the batting order. In Dozier's case in particular, after 28 homer average over the last 4 years, we've seen him try to hit fourth, we've seen him try to hit third. It hasn't gone that well. First or second, or either one's fine with Dozier, probably should be hitting second, but somebody else, you know, maybe Buxton at some point will show more on base and he'll end up first, whatever. But for now, I have no problem leaving Dozier at the top, because the numbers have indicated, and his life experience, his professional experience, tells him that that's just a good feel for him. And they both talk about the art of scoring runs, and I think there's something to be said for the fact that even something as simple as getting good reads consistently on balls in the dirt and taking an extra base when a pass ball or wild pitch is possible. Dozier has a far greater percentage, it seems, on taking those extra bases. So he does not make dumb outs on the bases, whereas some of the other younger players are still in that mode.
I'll tell you why I don't hate Dozier leading off. From a peer standpoint of, at the end of the year, who do you want to have the most plate appearances on this team? And I know people get tied up in all the solo home runs. And one thing that I also think I'll like is that if Jorge Polanco hits near the bottom of that order, when they turn it over, you're going to have a guy on base for Dozier to drive in. Now, Eddie Rosario batting ninth, or, you know, 7, 8, 9, that might complicate things a little bit. And again, this is just a snapshot in time, and though Molitor insists that he likes what Dozier does there, you know, moving him down to second isn't that huge of a step either, and it's one of those deals where Mauer could lead off in front of him and obviously pollute the bases in front of him as well. But again, yeah, if Polanco's going to be on base for him batting eighth or seventh, that doesn't hurt anything either. But, you know, I just if at the end of the year you want Dozier to have 700 plate appearances, that's one way to do it.
Sure. And another thing that could happen fairly soon is Polanco's on base and switching ability really starts to take root, and he's your leadoff hitter.
Yeah.
And Dozier moves to two. I mean, that seems like and that's another thing where, because of the switch hitting, that would be pretty stable, those top two every day. And if Buxton's struggling, you move Kepler up to third against right-handers. I mean, whatever. I mean, he's got a lot of freedom to do this. The key is that Molitor's already been able to have conversations with all of his regulars and explain to them, don't take any of this personally. You might be dropped five spots in the order, depending on whether the starting pitcher is righty or lefty. It's not about you necessarily. It's about the overall. It's about how the whole thing works together. And we probably spend way too much time thinking about it, that's for sure. But it is, one of the elements of status, I guess. You're the cleanup hitter now, or, oh, you're the leadoff guy now. But it really comes down to, in the course of the game, are you able to do your job more often than not, or at least enough? And I think their offense should be fine.
One of my least favorite parts of opening day, it's kind of like getaway day or Sundays, is the post-game stampede into Paul Molitor's office. I likened it to the scene in Lion King when Mufasa gets trampled by wildebeest, and got a couple laughs in the clubhouse yesterday. But the first question came from a cameraman who said, talk about opening day. So in the spirit of that, I'm going to ask you a talk about question. Mike Berardino, will you talk about Miguel Sano's mammoth game-tying fourth-inning home run yesterday?
Sure.
Sure you will. So absolutely goes upper tank. I think what Molitor had surmised was Sano was upset that he missed that 3-1. I think it was a fastball in the second inning. And so he waited all of one pitch. In fact, I guess you could say he waited zero pitches, jumped all over the first pitch for, depending on your source, about a 420-foot home run to left center. Pretty impressive. I don't know where to leave it beyond that, but wow, that was a drive. The hardest hit ball in the big league so far through 2 days of the season.
Right, what was it, 113.8 or something
miles
per hour exit velocity? There'll be more of that. He'll probably hit 120 at some point. But the key is that he doesn't need to overswing ever to generate that kind of power. And, of course, the pop-up that you referred to second, that was hit probably about 400 feet in the air. It just went straight up. I liked, and I wrote about it going into the final week of spring training, I liked what I saw in the interactions between Miguel and James Rousen, the new hitting coach, and Rudy Hernandez right there in the mix as assistant hitting coach. I liked how much time Miguel was spending in the cages and how much time they spent talking, listening to each other and trying to build that comfort level, because Tom Bernanski worked as hard as anybody and had real good results with Miguel's final 3 months as a rookie. Last year there was some backsliding, and at some point that you change the voice, and that can be good or bad. I think the early indication, and I know Miguel Sano struck out 45% of the time in the spring, small sample size, but he was lost at certain periods. But by the same token, Rousen told me late in the spring that he wasn't worried about that, because Sano was he would go up there and work on different things. There are certain pitches that he was waiting for, maybe that he would take a different type of pitch for a strike. It's spring training, so it's not a pure indicator. The numbers can deceive in a variety of ways for all positions and all types, and even something as seemingly cut and dried as a 45% strikeout rate, where you would go, wow, that's not good. There were ways to explain it away, and James Rousen's able to do that. He's a really good communicator.
Mm-hmm.
He's really seems to have a real good eye, and one of the things that they want, and just look at his body of work with some of the young Cubs when he had that opportunity, and of course with this crop of Yankee hitters like Judge and Sanchez and Bird that all passed through his care. I think Miguel Sano, long as they keep talking and keep bouncing ideas off each other, Sano's confidence level is back, and he knows that he can work deep counts, and he knows that if he needs to jump on something that's early in the count, might be the best thing he sees, then he's going to do that. And also, they just mechanically, they want him to keep his hands inside the ball and not think so much about, he doesn't need to generate power. That's when you start getting around the ball and hooking the ball and just swinging through pitches wildly. I don't think you're going to see that as much from him this year.
Tell me I'm crazy. I think Rowlson kind of looks like Fernando Rodney when I see him walking through the clubhouse.
He has not done the Archer thing yet, so I'm pretty sure that they are not the same.
One and the same. anyway, great segue there. Outside of the home run to Mike Moustakas that actually opened up the fourth inning, Santana was in cruise control, four base runners, two walks, two hits allowed in seven innings. Between the walks to Kane in the first and seventh inning, he set down 15 of 16 batters, with Moustakas' home run being the only base runner mixed in there. I thought he looked really great. 10 swinging strikes. I counted 5 on the slider, 3 on the change, and 2 on the fastball. Actually, I didn't count them. Brooks Baseball did, but great reference.
I counted them too.
Okay.
And he only had 4 of those, and I do those in real time and give them to people on Twitter. And why the heck isn't every Twins fan following me on Twitter?
Yeah.
It just drives me nuts.
At Mike Berardino.
If you care at all about the team, give me a look.
I agree.
Give me a shot. I will overwhelm you with quantity, but there's a lot of quality in there too. And if you do care about the kind of stuff you're talking about, you don't need to wait until after the game for
True.
Brooks Baseball. I'm trying to give you these things in real time. Can't promise that I'll always do it. Certainly once the bullpen comes in, I have to slide into meeting deadline. I have to file a game story as the game ends. But Irvin had only gotten no strikeouts in the first 6 innings, of course, and just 4 swinging strikes in the first 6 innings. So it was interesting that he dialed it up and got 6 of those 10 swinging strikes in that 7th.
Yeah, struck out the side in the 7th after no strikeouts. That's crazy.
It is. It was weird because he did touch 95 early, but there were a lot of 91s, 92s in there, and even the slider was down in its. It was down in the low 80s several times instead of 84, 85. So there's some variance for any pitcher, but. And the conditions were such that maybe it was a little tougher to get loose or stay loose. I don't know. But when he needed to be himself and needed to have that big needed to come through with 3 punch outs, and after Molitor goes out there to check with him, when he has Taylor Rogers up in the bullpen, he came through. He can rise to the occasion. And I also like the fact that Miguel Sano ran in from third base and gave him a little pep talk. Not that this had anything to do with it, but it could have jacked him up that much more. And I liked how Sano said something like, you know, you're the man here. You know, you take care of business here, whatever. That's something he couldn't do when he was in right field because that would have taken too long.
Yeah.
But now that he's in third base, he can do these things. And it just shows a little more of the maturation and the comfort level that, Sano is not just here to hit.
I think that Santana was only at 82 pitches when Molitor went out to check on him, but with Rogers fully lathered up, Moss, a lefty, coming up, 8-man bullpen, I was fairly convinced that he might go to Rogers there. Were you surprised when Molitor turned around without giving a signal to the bullpen?
A little bit, yeah. That was, many times we saw the Pelfrey-Molitor conversations in 15, and generally those turned out poorly, even though the season went well, but when he'd leave him in. But Molitor made the point that Irvin's pretty honest, and he lets you know what he's feeling. So there's a range. There's the guys that the manager runs out there, and the guy looks you in the eye and always says, "Oh, I can do it. I got him. And he gives up a bomb. And there's the other side of it where you're maybe too honest, and Phil Hughes has been accused of this, but I think it's been good on balance that he'll tell you when he's fatigued and when he just doesn't have his best fastball anymore, and that's sometimes in the 6th inning or earlier. Mm-hmm. But he's been totally honest. And then there's Irvin, who I think also veteran, and Molitor has a trust level there, and even though it was opening day and all those factors you just laid out, he stuck with him, and he got what he needed. So Irvin Santana, for as long as this team we'll hold on to them. I think we'll give them really quality work and a total commitment. And the other thing that he does now that he's in a position to influence is Adalberto Mejia, who is his, as well as Barrios when he gets back here. So Mejia is following him around, you know, as you would expect. And they run together, and you know, for Mejia to keep up with Irvin, given the body types, that's a challenge in itself.
True.
But if he can keep up with him in the conversation, if he keep up with him in the conditioning, there's big upside in Mejia, and people are excited about it after that spring, and they should be. And then Barrios will be back here, I have to think, by sometime in early May. And Irvin can influence all that. So no matter what he can bring you in a trade this summer, which certainly if he keeps doing this, he should be able to bring three really interesting pieces. He also can right now influence you every fifth day, and he can influence two of the other starters pretty soon. So that's, you know, that's 60% of your rotation that Irvin Santana can directly influence with his professionalism and his experience and his general positive attitude, which, you know, it seems like it should be obvious that everyone should be positive about being a Major League Baseball player, but the fact is they're not. And he is very consistent in his personality and his dealings with anyone. And he treats people with respect, and that goes for veterans, that goes for kids, that goes for media, that goes for clubhouse people, and it's been a pleasure to have him around.
So the Twins didn't really get to Danny Duffy outside of the Sano home run. He had the changeup working, I think he was particularly baffling to Robbie Grossman, who usually hits lefties well. I think Bert Blyleven might have been running the PitchFX pitch calibrator because everything was a cutter. You had a spirited discussion about Irvin Santana's quote-unquote cutter, probably a backup slider that the algorithm or the cameras read wrong, but it was reading a lot of Duffy's changeups as cutters as well. And you know Bert with his little cutter, you know, says that a lot on the broadcast. But I thought Duffy was incredible. The Twins waited all of two pitches to jump on Matt Strom. And I felt like Strom was in hot water from the second he was on the mound. Just a little looper from Polanco on the second pitch of the inning. Then the bunt from Kepler that ended up being a single. You got to feel bad for Strom a little bit in that he didn't really do anything wrong short of not beating Kepler to first with that throw. And he was already in trouble. And, you know, I thought that the seventh inning – first I want to get your thoughts on Duffy's performance, and then we'll talk about the seventh inning and how it played out. But, yeah, I thought Duffy was fantastic.
Yeah, and made the point to Molitor after the game that, you know, it wasn't just the patience that the Twins showed against Strom in that goofy seventh inning. The key really was getting his pitch count up to 100 in six innings, and that took five three-ball counts to happen. That was part of it. And, of course, the strikeouts, he built up the eight strikeouts. He had to do extra work to get those.
Mm-hmm.
But even in some of the strikeouts, you know, if you've seen six or seven pitches or more, that can help the cause. And that eventually got into a bullpen that has always been their strength in Kansas City. But on this particular day, it wasn't. I'm having a bit of a flashback here, and all this talk about one game, though, I must tell you, to my NFL days. This is what you do. This is what you do in the NFL. You play one game, and you got to sit around for 7 days before you play another one. And it's just talk, and you spend the next several days looking back. We rewatch the game, we blog ad nauseum, we go on shows and talk about the one game, and then we look ahead to the next game. But thank goodness baseball has enough games that we don't have to do this regularly. I realize it's an off day
sure.
in a podcast, but I don't have to tell you guys. It's not that kind of sport, and so things that you might see on a Monday are completely irrelevant by Wednesday, and that's how it should be. That's the way I like it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a consistency of effort. It's about repeatability. It's about the ebbs and flows of the endless challenge of a Major League summer, and that's why I didn't really like covering the NFL because it was too much talk about a three-hour time period, and like you say, snapshot in time. But these things are only meaningful in that they they can be sustained, and or if it was a bad thing, if they're able to be avoided quickly. So people on Twitter who were saying Byron Buxton clearly needs a lot more work at the plate. He's not ready to hit third and all this stuff. That's why I said, well, good. You know, he only has 161 games to fix this.
Hope he can handle it.
You know, I nobody can break down a single baseball game. An entire book, Nine Innings, was a book Daniel Okrent wrote many years ago, can be written about in one game or beyond the sixth game by Gammons. But this game was not historically significant. I'm sure of that. And I'm looking forward to games two through 162. And I would be looking forward to them even if the Twins had lost 30-0 yesterday. I would still be looking forward to those games. I was at the game in the spring where they lost 19-0, I believe it was, at the Rays.
Yep.
And the beauty of that is, A, it was spring, and B, you know, you talk to Molitor for 4 minutes after the game, and he's not throwing anything around, and he'd be the same if they lost 19-0 in a regular season game, and it should be, and I think the whole team would be. They're not going to be knocked off stride too much. Talent will tell over a period of time, but what I saw this spring, what I saw even at times last year, there are things worth watching here, there are things worth exploring further on your show and in future episodes.
Well, here's the last thing I got before we let you go. I did think, and I don't know if this is the Pickler factor or what, but I did see some small things that I thought reflected well on their preparation. After the first Kane walk, Brandon Moss wrapped into a double play, and Jorge Polanco was standing right where the ball was hit for the most part. Now, could be a bit of a lefty shift. I'm sure Moss has one of those tendencies to pull the ball, as a lot of lefty sluggers do. But I just felt like that was a spray chart thing. And then later in the game, on the second Castro hit that scored runs 5 and 6, when Alex Gordon threw home, Miguel Sano went from second to third. Then Jorge Polanco rolled a ball through first base, second base side, allowing Sano to easily score. And I felt like Sano did a really nice job moving second to third. Again, somebody tweeted me and said, this is the kind of stuff you do in high school. I'm aware of that, but it's the kind of things that the Twins didn't do well enough last year to win ball games. Again, run 7 didn't matter yesterday, but maybe that does matter run number 7 when it's a 7-6 win in the middle of June, you know, when you're teetering on 500 trying to keep this thing going. I was just impressed with a couple of those small things that the Twins did yesterday.
Yes, and it's amazing that we've talked this much about one game, and a stat savvy dude like yourself hasn't even gotten me into the bunts, the back to back bunts. Oof. Kepler and Rosario.
I didn't like it, but I got to keep you to your schedule like we promised.
Yes, and so, but they did it. They did get the bunts down at least, and so the little things, as Molitor said, and. Yeah, I also thought it was cool that Sano, as Polanco, his boyhood friend, was grounding that single through the right side. Sano was running home clapping, you know, excitedly, as though that seventh run was the most important run he'll ever score.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, it's opening day. You want to have a nice opening day. But, you know, we can't read too much into it. But they couldn't have asked for too many more pleasant indicators. How significant, again, I would question, but pleasant indicators. And I would say that they did put in a lot of time this spring, and I saw it right to the last week of spring, on fundamental situations. I don't know that necessarily the usage of the spray charts will be any more accurate this year than in the last 2 years, because they really did ramp up their shifting, and they are all over that stuff day to day. But the one thing to keep in mind, too, is that Gene Glynn now is in charge of not just infield defense, but base running. Butch Davis was base running and outfield, so he's back with the Orioles. And Pickler's an extra set of eyes there, and he's going to be very useful, even though he was not an outfielder and he'd never coached outfield. He coached himself up on drills to help first step quickness, and Robbie Grossman swears that he's going to get back to being an average defender at least this year, thanks to the very simple drills that they were working on Sunday, even on the workout day, where Pickler had him in short outfield and was just hitting quick grounders at him and getting them just a little quicker reactions. But it's a very, very long season, endless summer, and it's about building habits that are sustainable, and that allows you to just crash right through those barriers that invariably pop up.
Well, on the bunts, as I let you go, the one thing that would be seen different is if Perez keeps that ball fair and it's a quick double play, that seventh inning goes down in flames instead of six runs coming across. So that's all I have to say with why I'm not sure about being rode on the bunts. But anyway, you've been listening to Midwest Swing for Mike Berardino of the St. Paul Pioneer Press, Tom Schreier, producer and co-founder of Cold Omaha and Zone Coverage. I'm your host, Brandon Warren. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.